Not yet. Not yet.
Not yet.
Okay. Now.
Now I have the pleasure of introducing my dear friend Gisho Warner, who has graced this venue many times in the past, and we are delighted to have her here talking about a subject that I am delighted that she has agreed to speak about tonight. She is the head teacher at the Stone Creek Zendo here in the West County as Soto Zen priest, and it is our great pleasure to have her here again to speak to us tonight. Thank you so much for coming.
I get embarrassed, it won't go so well. It's very nice to be here again, and I recognize quite a lot of the faces. So I have spoken here a few times before, and so I thought, well, okay, this time, what will I do? Something different, something juicy. What could be more juicy than the juices of our lives? So it's really about the juices of our lives, right? Passions, all the passions, all the excitations. And the only book I brought with me is one that that Robin Bill and Jim have put out, another version of Ikkyu, who's a great Zen monk and poet in Japan. And he asked, why is it that under the feet of the bright-eyed monk, the red thread is not yet severed? Well, the simple answer is because the bright-eyed monk takes place in a body, and the body has a red thread. What are we going to, we're not, how do you live, how do you, without abandoning any part of yourself? How do you have a spiritual practice without abandoning any part of yourself? And yet not just getting crazy and carried away. So I was thinking about passionate emotions and sexuality and spiritual practice, where we think we often think we want to do something that's different from that. The passionate emotions and sexuality aren't the only passions, so it really should be taken broadly, right? And I'll say some things, and then I really would like, I will in the middle of this turn this over to you, because there's as much experience here in meeting, swimming with and being overcome by passions as I have. I had a classic Zen training, which is a pretty monastic, and my robes were all black. Now they're not. Now I wear red robes and green robes and all kinds of robes. But we train in a way that, you know, dilutes color down to black and white and maybe a little brown. And the vagaries in some sects, brown is for the novices and you graduate to black, and others you start with black and you graduate to brown. There's this, in so many areas, a muting of our sensory intake, all of that sensory passionate intake. And the question is why? You know, how much of it is something that we would want? Because I'm talking here about passions and spiritual practice. And how much of it is something that we simply inherited out of a monastic and celibate and, sorry guys, but largely male tradition that tended to be less in touch with body feelings and less interested in that. You know, in the Buddhist tradition, the same impulse that said to monks that if they were having a difficulty with their passions, a problem with those women out there, is the same problem that says, you know, that emotions and passions should be sifted out to begin with. So what is the place of aroused states in spiritual practice? Or what is their relationship to it? I debated when I was thinking about this. So I'd say it's passions and spiritual practice. So I'd say it's passions in spiritual practice. Well, there isn't a bit of difference between those two, because if you have a spiritual practice is intended to inform your life. But spiritual practice has good reasons for tending to want to drop levels of excitation. Very good reasons for this. And then there's very good reasons for questioning this. You know, full-time practice tends to be celibate in many traditions. But especially in a practice like the Dharma, not only Zen, we're asked to reinvent it. And here we are in a time and place where we understand that emotion has value. But what kind of value? And what is its place in your spiritual practice? And what is its place in your life? My good friend Ikkyu, he of the red thread of passion, was a very famous Zen monk in a time of great turbulence in Japan. He was a great poet, he was a great monk, and he was a great womanizer and a great drunk. Among did all these things. At some point, with but not all at the same time. And then, but because at one point he was compelled against his own wishes to take over one of the big temples in Kyoto, and that meant responsibility for all kinds of fundraising and everything else. And eventually he managed to make himself persona non grata in that role and to leave it. He wrote a poem called Self-Appraisal. Crazy madman stirring up a crazy style, coming and going amid brothels and wine shops. Which of you patch-robed monks can trip me up? I mark out the south, I mark out the north, the east, and the west. As I am here and fully present, how about you who are practicing with such seriousness? And then another poem, he ends with a line that says, a taste of honey, and we forget the danger at the bottom of the well. The same guy, you know, as long as we live in a human body, we're going to have more than one mind. That's part of it. How are you going to live with contrary impulses towards a quiet practice and an inclusive, passionate practice? How are you going to live with all of those differences? So, in terms of a spiritual practice, which is itself, which is not the only thing we want to look at, within the, shall we say, the formal spiritual practice, a time when you say, this is what I'm doing as my spiritual practice, that's one of your activities. It's usually not the same one as sexual activity, unless you're doing a certain kinds of tantra, right? It's not the same as necessarily as eating lunch or going to the bank. These are all, or going to your job. There are different activities in our lives, and so there's a sense in which a spiritual practice is done as a particular activity. I don't sit glued to a zafu and float around the world. I sit down and then I get up and go out. So in the time of doing your spiritual practice, what is the role there? Of passion, or passionate emotion, or even sexual arousal, for that matter. All kinds of things come up. So it's... There shouldn't ever be one right answer, even for one person. Different times of our lives, and different call for different kinds of practices. And it is to disavow an old practice to take up a different frame. But so the aim or goal of your spiritual practice, in Zen we try to wash out our mouths every time we utter bad words like goal, but aim, we consider aim a reasonable word. Because a goal sets something outside you, apart from you. But so, if the aim of your spiritual practice is a tranquil state, we live confused, busy lives, and a tranquil state is something we prize, we want to know, or maybe even to have, and we do need to pay attention to that, of course. But if it's a tranquil state that we're aiming for in our practice, then you have to separate and exclude mental states that are not conducive to that tranquil state. Passions, hot emotions, best you can. And you can do that. You can do a lot that will... I want to save discussion for a little later, but don't let it go. You can do practices that are very valuable that aim at disengaging you from or not attending, or actively not attending, to passionate emotions in the pursuit of perhaps... an experience of tranquility that you might hope to then take out or have as a base to go somewhere else, but as a state of quietness or calmness But then you have to face that that tranquil state in itself will not in itself inform your life. You know, the having or reaching some kind of tranquility or a calmness or a quietness will not in itself automatically connect with the rest of your life. You can't carry it with you. It happens where it happens. You move to a different condition. You're in a different condition. So if you're going to do a practice about a tranquil state, which is perfectly valid kind of practice, then you have to say, well, how will I bridge to the hotter times of my life? Or am I going to say I don't want to have them? It would be pretty dicey, as well as impossible. And would you want to say that? Well, some of us say, well, I want to have calm throughout my life. And it's not enough to say, well, good luck. There is that. But there's a real question of whether that's what is truly can be truly accomplished that way. What is the aim of a life that includes some but not and some states and some minds and not others, or some emotions and not others? It's hard to know then what filters to use. How do you separate or what to include and what not to include? Does anger have a place? Does sorrow have a place? Sorrow is a pretty hot emotion. Does grief have a place? Does laughter have a place? Does jumping up and down and giggling have a place? Do other kinds of passions have a place? What about the other passions that are the passion for an ideal? Those are high. Sometimes we, of course, run come proper because of that. So there are many hot states in our lives, including a passion for spiritual practice. And so we really need to look closely at what the aim or goal of our spiritual practice is in order to have a sense of how we're going forward with it. Not to make assumptions. You know, some people say that they want to have an experience of emptiness, or, you know, the spirit, some Zen traditions where there's an emphasis on Kensho or Satori, those are kind of hot states too. If you want to have a practice that is an insight into life, then you need an inclusive practice. And that's why I do Zen. Because I need to learn how to live as a person with a lot of emotions, half of which I don't understand. I don't even know until they're there, right? Which is, of course, one of the problems. How do you do a spiritual practice in a life without excluding what's inconvenient? And without getting carried away. Which is why there's such a tendency to reduce the connection to hot states and emotions and excitation and arousals of all sorts is because they're so hard to handle. So I was thinking before I came over earlier today about the relationship of intensity and passion. Would one want to live without intensity? Intensity is the vividness of connection with life. What's the relationship of passion to indulgence? We tend to be indulgent about our passions, but does that mean that passion is indulgent? What about passion and restraint? Is restraint something that's intended to stop passion? It's often practiced that way. But I personally don't think that's what it's about. And from the perspective of the Buddhist tradition, what about desire and clinging? What about desire? There's so much that's said about what's wrong with desire, about how painful and suffering it is, and how it essentially traps your mind. I lived for years in a cabin in the woods in New England, in Massachusetts, and my sangha, there were some birch trees, a few beech trees. And they were, so I sat with them, and eventually I realized that they were not without desire. They were kind of a model for me of a calm, of an acceptance that I didn't have of life. They accepted the seasons. They accepted the squirrels. They accepted the aphids. They accepted all kinds of things. But they were not without a desire for sun, a desire for water, a desire for nutrients, a kind of natural urge of life to desire to continue living. And there are, even within Buddhism, there's really, in a sense, a split between, are you going to say I want to practice in a way that turns me into something else, or in which I become fully human? So I'm with EQ. We want to be fully human, even though we're kind of crazy on the way to it. But if you're going to be fully human, you have to say that, rather than to try to leave being human. So the early Buddhism was, as a scholar I know described it as, a practice of trying to find the way to the exit ramp from the highway of life and desire, the exit ramp to nirvana. And he was maybe a little rash with that, but there's been a movement increasingly towards saying, well, I want to find a way to be fully human, and I want then my practice to inform that, my life to inform that practice, so that there's a flow back and forth, so that my life might even have coherence. So I saw the trees, and I said, okay, there's natural desire that is not, you can't say that the natural, I choose not to say that the natural activity of life happening and continuing is in any way wrong. It's what is natural, and this is the Dharma, as I understand it, which is my tradition, says this is a natural universe, a universe in which we have to live with life and death of impermanence and interconnection, interbeing, a natural universe, and being alive is a natural condition. Of course, being confused is a natural condition too. So we get confused. So passion, emotion, desire, clinging, and rejection get lumped together. And I, insofar as distinguishing is often useful and then has to be thrown away, desire that is clinging and grabbing toward me and grasping, a desire that is a pushing away, a desire that impedes life or that tries to tell you how you should be for my purposes, for instance, or how you should not be for my purposes, those are unhealthy and unwholesome and not conducive, not in harmony, not in accord with the life of the natural universe. But that's not all of desire. So I don't think it's easier to do a practice where you want to exclude passion and desire. It's easier on the mind, but it's not easier to do. None of them are really easy to do. Life isn't easy to do. But we get carried away. All of our hot states have a tendency to overwhelm us. Or maybe they don't, or maybe we just fall so in love with them that we let ourselves get carried away, however we want to describe that. There's having an emotion or having an interest or having a passion, and then there's it having you or being overwhelmed, being distracted. You see, all the passions work by narrowing your focus. You know, we have so much, we don't have an unlimited sensory input ability, right? Pretty wide, pretty diverse, and then as we narrow it in on something, we focus in, we can be passionately attentive to something. Now, this happens in running, this happens in roulette, this happens in studying. This happens with an emotion. Emotions work that way. They narrow the focus of our attention. So does a sewing. So does chopping an onion. But narrow our focus. And what narrows our focus, then there's less range of input, and the narrower and more intense the focus, the more likely we are not to notice what we don't see, not, and therefore lose the input of the fact that we've now got turned into some kind of a one fierce track, and we realize 2 hours later that our back is like this and we can't move because we've been staring at a computer screen for 2 hours. So that very intensity that we seek, that any passion has, then becomes its own demon, its own has its own shadow. It flips into a carried away kind of state, a distracted state where we don't know, we don't get input to say that we've lost track of where we are. That's why I said zazen with our eyes open, because at some point we're going to say, "Oh my God, I'm sitting here staring at a white wall." And I thought I was doing this other something else. And for years I thought that I should learn not to get carried away by that something else. And I could have a couple of sometimes you get a couple of minutes of tranquility and clarity and you say, "Ah, that's it." But in fact, there's as much learned from the fact of getting distracted and what it takes to wake up and what you do with where you were and how you come back with the experience of a gap. So too with emotions. One of my favorite lines in all of the Zen koan literature is, "What will you do when the foaming waves wash the very sky?" So about 4 or 5 years ago, my life turned upside down, and there was nothing but a great wash of emotion. I didn't know choice. I was either going to have emotion, or I was going to have emotion, or I was going to have emotion. And there weren't even that many different ones, you know. But at that time, you know, they get wide, they get broader again. But when there's not, that's what there is. Well, that's what there was sitting, and I had no choice but to include what I had thought would be better left to another time. You know, I thought, well, I'll have my passion here and I'll have sex there. I don't come, luckily, from a celibate line, but from a sort of marrying or partnering tradition. So I had to study pretty intensively what it meant to do my daily meditation practice, or, you know, in the morning and in the evening and every day, with just washed with the foaming waves washing the empty sky endlessly. So I found that's what you do then. If that's what there is to do, that's what you do. My ideas about what practice were like, my ideas about my own spiritual ground were out the window. But there was still showing up. And then I realized that that's what it's about. It's about showing up with whatever there is and then finding a way to be with that. Now, I don't recommend that we would always wash all our emotions or our arousals through our spiritual practice, because that too becomes a rather limiting thing. But we have to live with what is there, and including in the midst of our spiritual practice, because that is what is there. Then we can see something about it. Because there too, if you're doing in the context of active spiritual practice, even when something very hot state comes up, now if it's a very mental state, if it's anger and hatred, well, you get to see your mind carrying on and in shenanigans, and there's a lot to be learned from it. Not just distaste. There's a lot else to be learned about what goes on there, about how it grabs, how you can let it go and not let it go, and how you can return to being present in yourself in a broader way without having to excise part of yourself. You begin to see the difference between anger and hatred, the difference between sorrow and just a general emotionality. If that's what's there, that's what you work with. And at another time, things quiet down and you have that to work with. And years and years of a spiritual practice, especially, will not in itself suffice to teach you how to live in the world. None of them know. D.T. Suzuki, who was the great exponent of Satori, all his books, the great master who was so influential in scholar and master in mid-20th century, it was Satori, Satori, Satori. Late in his life, at the end of World War II, he had a hard time in Japan, World War II. He was married to an American. He was kind of suspect for his liberal views, and he kept fairly quiet. He just wrote to friends of his great distress at things. And at the very end of the war, he published an article. It was already there for him to publish, in which he said, look at all these masters and all of their Satori. Now, really, he believed in their great Satori enlightenment understanding. And he said, they were all supporting this war. He said, I now understand that whatever you do in a formal practice will not in itself inform you about the rest of life. He said, maybe they should have studied economics too. Maybe they should have studied history. That, you know, if you want to understand an economic reality, you might have to study economics, not just have Satori. He says it more eloquently, of course, but it's very moving from a man who was so deeply immersed in the value of the special spiritual experience as complete for your whole life. I think that a strong spiritual practice is complete as it is, a state of tranquility or a state of awareness, perhaps more, because I'm not much good at tranquility. A state of awareness is a state, or the practice of Zazen is complete as it is. All my teachers, all these Japanese teachers always say, Zazen is complete, is a complete practice. And I finally understood that all of these practices are complete as they are for what they are. That does not mean they're the complete expression of your whole life. In Zen, we say you still need the precepts. You still need to understand in other contexts how to act in other contexts. But they connect. I think one of the most important things in a spiritual practice is its connection to the rest of our life. The aim for a coherent life, because we all live pretty painfully discontinuous lives. We all have gaps. We all stopped short by the gaps in our lives. And so we're all looking for things that will cross that or bridge that or blend, but help us flow. Whether it's from moment to moment or activity to activity or value to value, happen there. Spiritual practice also relates to your emotional life and your sexual life. How do you learn to show up for everything as it is? You know, I don't have answers. But they are very good questions. I've always felt the questions were better than answers. They last longer. But there's something good about that. You know, the fact that any answer we come up with is provisional is not really a problem unless we think it's a problem. Right? Answers are always provisional because they're specific to specific circumstances. They ought to be, or they won't serve us for much. But a good question, you can go on digging through a lot of changes of circumstances. So the question of how will I live with passions? And what kinds of passions do I want to live with? And what kind of passions do I have no choice about living with? And what about other people's passions that I have no choice about living with? Right? I'm very fond of this monk Ikkyu. Because he knew that he had to live, that he had no choice but to be a passionate creature. And he tried to find his own way over and over and over without hiding anything to being both passionate and quiet. And because, you know, we have to remember, passion narrows your view. Its intensity is marvelous. And it's a narrow one. That's how it works. And we can't only do that. But we can't only sit in a kind of a broad, open field either. How do you do both? How do you honor Bob? I'm going to do what people talk to, you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama about, the precepts in the, of the princess of harboring hatred or harboring anger. And he thinks Americans, Westerners generally, talk an awful lot about, are very concerned about anger and is expressing it. He's not so sure about the expressing it part. He said, well, if you have to have it, do you have to express it? Yes. But in what way? But in what way? What will be skillful? What is a skillful way to own and practice a passion? You better tell me. So, what do you do when the foaming waves wash the very sky? Or what do you do when you have passion come up in your life, in your spiritual practice? Is it a problem in spiritual practice, or is it a problem in your life generally, or is it just juicy, if there is such a thing as just? You got a question. Let me find this. Move
it's
on.
Not relevant anymore, but to respond to what you just said, my practice gets hotter the more I do it, so it's kind of like it's a lot to push towards that step more. Push myself, I guess.
I'm always trying to look closely at the urge to push, because when we're pushing toward, we're also pushing away. Pushing is a dubious enterprise that we're all prone to, but we're pushing toward something. We're tending to be also pushing away something, and I was not seeing a lot. So I would say, look at the pushing, you know? Look at the pushing.
How do you state the second and third noble truths?
The first noble truth is that life is replete with suffering, imbued with suffering, ineradicably non-separate from suffering. Sometimes it said life is suffering, but I don't think so. But then the second noble truth is about the origin of suffering. And it says clinging or grasping, thirsting, tanha, thirsting and grasping is the origin of suffering. And so that has been taken as desire. But I don't, as I say, I don't think that's fair. I think that's too much is lumped in there. The grasping after, when I grab something, it takes the life out of it. It perverts it. I squeeze it out of shape. I take it out of its true context in life. I pull it toward me, and I pull away from it away from its roots. I'm in some sense violating the natural order with grasping, or with pushing away, with rejecting, and that kind of clinging is also not seeing. So that creates suffering. But I don't see that all desire, all desiring, all wanting is that. At all. So the third is that the ending of grasping and clinging is nirodha, it's not originally nirvana, is cessation, is a piece of cessation. And there is no way in a human life to have one state be the state of our life. We're not static beings. So to have a state among others in your life that is a complete calm, that's a wonderful thing. And there a time of not desiring or clinging at all, a time of an open hand. And then can we take some aspect of that, the open hand, back to the world where we have an urge to grasp and instead desire that someone flourish for themselves rather than desire that they flourish my way, for instance. And because it's so hard, then we have the Eightfold Noble Path to tell us how to get there, how to do all this, which is all about thinking and view and livelihood and, you know, and all these other practices, other ways of reaching, of acting. And because none of us is going to really get it, frankly, get it right about desire on our own. We're all deluded creatures. You know, I have the idea that what I desire is really a natural desire, you know. And so I'm... and in spiritual practice, it happens a lot. Maybe it happens all to everybody, but in spiritual practice, or God forbid, as a spiritual teacher, there's a great tendency to believe that, that you've got it right about desire, and that because you have some insight, that your understanding of desire is wholesome. And then we have all the spiritual leaders in all different traditions who wind up in breaking all kinds of sexual wholesomeness. So we have a precept in Zen, which would be essentially equivalent of what it's part of the Eightfold Noble Path is follow your precepts. And the precept in Zen says, not engaging in unwholesome sexuality. Well, if you happen to be vowed to celibacy or in a celibate retreat, stay with it. You know, that's your vow and your aim, and you want, there's a lot to be learned. There's a great deal to be learned from that. But if it's, if you're married, you would do well to be monogamous, to honor the person. If you have a partner, to honor the partner. That's whole. What are the aspects of wholesome sexuality? So it's not to say that we should be without desire. The question is, in what way are we going to live with our desires, and what guidelines are we going to have beyond ourselves? Because none of us is going, our own ideas is going to be sufficient. Any time a Zen teacher, or not just Zen, but Tibetan teachers, every one of the Buddhist traditions has the idea that they understand, that they, you know, their understanding is going to carry them home without following the precepts, they come a cropper. Badly. They do harm. So there's that question. What is desire? What kind of desire? And what is going on in my desire? My litmus test. I have a kind of a litmus test for myself, which is, will including this passion in my life or excluding this passion help me refine my life or hinder me? And refining my life is refining my connections with others, enlargement, as much as with myself.
So wouldn't any human interaction, by that definition, like enhance your connectedness with other people because they're a different person?
No, not every interaction is productive. If someone yells at me, I'm going to have trouble hearing them because of my particular condition. And I might find a way to relate them skillfully, or they to me. If someone just turns away, turns their back on me and walks off, I will not, there will not be, but there's interaction, something is said, but not enough to have an ongoing exchange. So refining my life is increasing, refining the subtlety of my connection and my own ground and insight in my life. So I think all of the spiritual practice is about refining our lives, refining the ways in which we learn to hear. So every interaction is real in a sense, but is it productive? Is it increasing our ability to connect? Am I learning to hear and to listen? That's a tough one. I need someone sometimes to yell at me to tell me to do that. You know. Does the interaction increase my being awake to life and to this interaction? Do I see more? Can I see more in this person in this interaction? Or can I see less because I'm, you know, calling it that?
But to go a little further in this, yeah. You know, this notion of individual discernment as to what person refines, you know, your sense, okay. You know, if one is to engage with desire, like in terms of a partner or another person, mm-hmm. How does that assessment or that litmus test, to use the term used, this is a nice one, how does that approach itself in terms of interpersonal relationships where there is a person who's interested or desirous of you and you're desirous of that person? I mean,
Okay, well, if I'm desirous of them, but they're married to someone else, or I'm married to someone else,
I have to stop.
Then I have to know that, despite the strong horses of desire, I better not. But I'm in a relationship and I'm having difficulty communicating. This is normal human stance, right? Mm-hmm. I'm having some difficulty actually hearing. I want to figure out what will help me hear that person's heart more. That's where I will learn and my heart will be open. If I want my heart to enlarge, which I basically do in life, it keeps going, it keeps constricting and turning into a hard little dried up plum. And I keep wanting to soak it and extend it. And to do that is to look to another's heart. That's an important one for me. When I want to understand more, I need to look to another's mind, or mind and heart and feelings. I need to remember that a thought without a feeling value is kind of empty. What will contribute to meaning in this connection? What will contribute to joy in it? What values do I want to have in my connection with you? And what are the ways to go there? But I always then have to also stop and step back, and I can't help but step back, and see how I want the other person to do it my way. And that's, I'm always reminding myself that I already know what I think, and I want to learn what somebody else thinks. So every time I want to turn someone into doing it my way, I want you to be a good practitioner. My way, I squeeze the juice out of that other person rather than increasing it.
I'm so appreciative of the energy and vision that you bring to myself and everybody. They're moved. And I hear so poignantly the many challenges and questions that you presented, that there are so many needs that we have to answer and have an answer, and there's so many incredible areas, and we're all trying just to bring our involvement manifestation in accord with the universal spirit that is within us. And so I think there's one answer to every question, and it's one that they don't usually mention. I went to the Church of Religious Science and they don't use the word, but it's the thing that answers every one of these questions about how to relate to ourselves, our desires, how do we manage our passions? What is the guiding light that helps us embrace those in the way that's most meaningful? And as I can understand, someone even wrote 8 different paths on how to get there. But they don't use the word, and the word is love. And answers every one of those questions. And it's the only light that sheds any light on any of our existence and our relationships and how we relate to ourselves. And I wish people could have more in their culture such as this to encourage us all to grow that like a fire, and that be our central focus. When you said it's not having the intensity of passion has a limiting factor to it. If it's love, it doesn't have a limiting factor and opens up everything that's meaningful in our spiritual life and our existence as a human being. So,
love is larger than, it's not what I call a passionate emotion. It doesn't have that narrowing quality. So then I wind up having to say, here's one of the best digging sticks of them all. What is love? What is the way to express love now? Love meaning is a word meaning connection.
Meaning right? Caring for meaning someone else.
Meaning caring or seeing or connecting and yes, understanding that I am in connection. So
that's
a very good
thing in your life. It's the reason we're alive is how we can love and manifest that love. Spiritual practice is just some guidance to help us to try and get clarity to get on that path. But that is the goal of every breath that we take and every spiritual practice, is how can we love more and be more open and receive the fullness. That's the only place that there is a fullness.
I think that's one of the best ways to phrase that whole large question, but it's not the only one. I've lived more of my time with what is honesty. What is the honest thing for me to do here? And it's not a different question necessarily, right? There's a different angle on it. We have to have more than one way to express the great questions, and that's one of the finest.
Honesty is naturally part of love.
Yeah. What do you want to say?
word paradigm is very important. There are certain paradigms where certain things which seem in conflict with each other and seem to be having a very difficult time with each other shift into another paradigm, and suddenly they're embracing each other.
Like passion and spiritual practice.
Yeah. That's why I liked very much what you were saying about questions and answers, because we're a very answer-based reality, and when we shift into the question base, and when people are sharing the same questions, then that makes for an intimacy that's different than if they're espousing separate answers. I like seeing the questions like the tree, and the answers are like fruit. And as long as you're nourishing the tree, then you can pick fruit and have answers whenever you want them. And
on all different ones, right?
Yeah, take a bite out of this.
But one of the ways you said that, you know, there's love is one of the ways to phrase this. Honesty is one, and intimacy is one. That's another way to describe. A particular way to describe the role of passion, because all the passion is about, the narrowing is also about connection, intimate connection, vivid connection. And we want that. That's fair and right to want. And then there's also so many other aspects of intimacy. So that's one way to look at our human relationships. What will build a true intimacy between me and another person? That doesn't remove boundaries, but true intimacy doesn't do that either. Because I can't be intimate with someone I'm trying to bend them out of shape. Much as I try, you know. that's not going to do it. So intimacy is one of the ways, I would say, that we could describe that refining our life and our relationships. And one more thing that we're probably will need to stop.
It just come up a couple weeks plus a few days retreat, and I'm very attached to this tranquility. So nice to be away from this clutching, contracting, grabbing, you know, constant, you know, stuff getting triggered all the time. It's just so nice to be pulled out of the change. It's like a vacation away from that stuff. And I come back and, you know, you realize that, well, it's almost like, you know, you're sitting real concentratedly and you can see how even just a little preface is like really, it's a kind of unpleasant little contraction. Just a little mind moment of, you know, mild desire or preference. It is a contraction. It is it's unpleasant. And then you just pop out in the world and you just, it's just almost natural to want things. And that's just kind of the mystery that I'm looking at right now. It just seems almost weird that it's a desire is inherently unpleasant, you know, in some ways, and that it's also so natural. So it feels so good to do. It feels so right to do. It's very weird.
But we're trying to do one thing called being focused and quiet. Then preference, we see the shadow side of preference. But it doesn't mean that preference only has the shadow side. It isn't only suffering. It isn't only wrong. And so, you know, Zazen is a lot messier than some other practices that have more clear focus. And but that's, it's a practice of living in the middle of preferences, and it's messier. But then at the end of a retreat, it's I sometimes, maybe after another 10 or 20 years, the connection will be greater between the time of living without preference. I mean, when you do a Zen retreat, we're surrendering to a time of no personal preference. The bell rings, you sit down. The bell rings, you get up. And meanwhile, you know that you're saying, you know, I'm having preferences. And so, but the Zen container is not to say, I don't want to do that. What I do is I have to sit in the middle of having preferences in the middle of and no preferences and how to put them together.
Yeah, I'm not saying they stop. I'm just saying it's just so clear.
It's clear that if you're aiming to do a particular practice, then something that's outside of that is suffering. Preferences, then all preference can be suffering because it directs, takes you away, narrows your view. But at other times, it's absolutely essential. You cannot cross a street without having a preference for a green light over a red light. You know, this is a good thing to have. I remember Reb Anderson once said, you really need an ego because you need to know where to put your lunch. He sometimes was very pithy, right? And in the same way, we need to know true kinds of preferences. A relationship that's wholesome versus one that isn't. The fact that we want to see something real everywhere does not mean we should throw ourselves in the path of all kinds of traffic. You know, so preferences are necessary, and skillful preference is skillful means is at the heart of the Buddhist practice. There's a very importantly positive side of preference that isn't just being jerked around. But yes, we are largely jerked around by our preferences, sure. But it isn't only that. It really isn't only that. It isn't just that we're seduced into enjoying it. Well, there's that too. Okay, maybe one last comment.
Bring it back to this. I'm just always so surprised, sort of startled to hear love, passion, intimacy in the context of Zen, because I don't see it in the tradition.
Oh yeah, you get these. The Buddhist tradition was largely male. It suppressed the female a lot. The nuns got written out. Tended to be celibate, the monk tradition. And there was a division in Asia of largely, but not exclusively, of monks did the serious practice, and they were supposed to be celibate. They often weren't. And lay people made donations. And in coming, the turning of the Dharma wheel in the West, is a vast increase in really potent lay practice. One of the greatest gifts of this coming of Dharma to the West. And so, but it's not just that lay people practice, but that the information that comes in is that that real people doing real practice have real emotions. And also, Western psychology is a very valuable thing. Buddhism had one of the first psychologies anywhere. It was a conceptual psychology, largely. 2,500 years, well, at least by 2,000 years ago, it was a well-developed cognitive kind of psychology. The West has this great personality psychology, personal psychology. There's tremendous richness in that. How do we integrate that with the Dharma? That's our job in the next, you know, couple hundred years. So,
but is the 2,000-year Dharma tradition from which you are originating capacious enough? Or
yes. One of my teachers, all my teachers were Japanese, most of them are Japanese men, and Kozen, master still alive. Once when I was in Milwaukee, I lived in Minneapolis, was part of the center there, and I would go for 10 days a month to Milwaukee and live up on the third floor, a nice little temple monkey, and just be up there and sit Zazen and help and go back upstairs. It was very kind of a very monkish life. And I didn't go out, and I didn't do things. I studied, and I worked, and I sat. And one Sunday afternoon, everything was very quiet. There was sitting at the kitchen table downstairs and studying something, and Tozin came in, and without saying a word, plunked a six-pack of beer down on the kitchen table and walked out. You know, don't be too pure, dear. I didn't say drink them all at once. You know. But I took a lesson from that. Just as all my teachers knew that I was a lesbian, and it was their job to deal with it, even though they were Japanese men. So some of the cream of the crop of idiosyncratic and iconoclastic Zen priests came to the West because it was kind of, you know, there were constraints on the way they could express their practice in Asia. And they came here and lived in exile and seasick for the rest of their lives because there was something vital to develop here. So yes, bringing emotion and passion as an actual, how do we relate to that as who we are and in our practice, and rather than just kind of reining ourselves in. That's the Japanese cultural model as well as a Buddhist model. So if you just rein yourself in harder, well, that's not, I don't see that as the most productive. Most of us don't see that as the most productive. But we don't really know, we don't have a lot of good answers yet. But it is, I have found plenty to draw on in the tradition that's empowered me, Latter-day lesbian feminist. We've all empowered them. You know. I'm a missionary to the heathens here from Japanese Soto school. I mean, I trained in Japan as well as here, and in a women's training monastery, and I'm certified in Japan and here, and I actually have a little position called missionary to the humans. They don't quite call it that. They call it overseas mission, and they give me a little tiny stipend. But so even that tradition has, in its own way, empowered me. Although they do understand that for most of the Japanese, I'm a little bit outspoken. But they don't disavow me for that. So it works. It works. We better stop. It's 8:30. Jim or Rob wants to say something else here now.
Well, first I want to say how grateful I am that you are outspoken here tonight. Thank you so much on behalf of Many Rivers Books and Tea. That's wonderful. And second, I want to thank you all for coming tonight and adding your energy and intelligence to this very intelligent discussion of a very interesting topic. And I want to point out we have a donation bowl. We follow the Buddhist practice of dana, or generosity, and we share that the proceeds from that with our speakers so that their work can be supported. And use our half to support this space for future such explorations, as I hope there will be with this speaker as well as others in times to come. So I encourage you to look at that. We also have, Jim, I believe, has placed some perhaps relevant, and I'm sure relevant, books. I haven't looked at them myself. That's why I said perhaps. But I know they're relevant. I'm certain that they're relevant.
Right.
Wonderful and brilliant books to look at over here.
This guy said to me in 1982 81 when I went to him, and I said, I really want to be a regular student of yours. And he said, fine. And I said, well, there's one more thing I need to tell you. And I said, I'm a lesbian. Oh, my God, he doesn't approve. There's nothing happening here. What am I going to do now? I said, well, I'm a nice lesbian. I'm in a stable relationship. Nothing. Finally, I said, do you know what it is? And he had one member of his sangha had already expressed herself as a lesbian to him, and he said, "It isn't bad. It isn't good. What's her name?" There's a book of poetry here too, "The Crow with No Mouth," that red thread.
Well, excellent books, obviously.
Excellent.
So thank you all so much for coming out tonight and joining us, and thank you again.
And thank you for having this series. It's really wonderful. Wonderful to come here. And thank you for coming.
It's lovely to have such, I hope you don't blush, such intelligence brought to you.